from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, coming to you today from KQED's San Jose Bureau. In this hour forum, we take up the issue of online privacy, our right to have it versus our ability to really control the information that's out there about us. The Trump administration's proposal to require certain people to surrender their social media passwords as a condition of U.S. entry is also prompting renewed questions about what level of privacy from the government we can expect. Join our conversation with noted journalists and experts on digital privacy who will give practical advice on taking control of your digital identity and maybe even your life. We'll get started after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. And you're listening to Forum, not from our usual San Francisco studio, but from our Silicon Valley desk in San Jose. And for the occasion, we're discussing the very tech-oriented topic of digital privacy, which feels ever more elusive these days as we give up more and more personal information for the conveniences of communicating with others, buying things, or researching topics. Joining us for this hour, the panel of experts who've spent a lot of time thinking and learning about digital privacy, as well as trying to protect it in hopes of helping all of us have some level of control over the online information that's out there about us in this era of attention merchants, Russian hacks, and proposals for increased government surveillance. This panel is probably first going to freak you out about how little privacy there is today around your personal information and online identity, but then they'll help us learn how to take at least some control of our digital identity without having to opt out of all the conveniences and rewards of being online. And let me tell you who they are. We're joined by Manoush Zomorodi. She is the host of Note to Self, a tech podcast about being human from WNYC Studios. Good morning, Manoush Zomorodi.
Good morning, Mina.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to Julia Angwin. She's senior reporter for ProPublica. Good morning, Julia Angwin.
Good morning.
Thank you as well. And thanks to Larry Magid, technology journalist, internet safety advocate, and CEO and co-founder of ConnectSafely.org. He's also he serves as the on-air technology analyst for CBS News, KCBS, and the Mercury News. Good morning to you, Larry Magid.
Good morning, Mina.
And I'll start with you if I could, Larry. I think part of the freak out, or at least what I experienced in researching for this show, is that people's expectations of how much privacy they have frequently does not match up with reality. And I just want to start by hearing from you what you find are the most common misconceptions you encounter.
Well, I think the most common misconception is that your privacy is jeopardized by some other source, that it's going to be a hacker or the government or a corporation. And those are all issues, as Julia has very competently exposed over the years in her writing. But actually, much of the privacy that we give up is because of our own mistakes or bad judgment. Things like posting something on Facebook that maybe you shouldn't be sharing, or something that I've observed a number of times where people are mean to be sending somebody a message, a personal message, but they're instead putting something on their page. They're posting it instead of a private message. So you're sending something that you think is private, but in fact you're sending it in public. Failure to have strong passwords. Privacy and security are very intertwined. If you don't have security, you can't have privacy. And so I think those are the things that we need to focus on in terms of the low-hanging fruit that we have control over. And then we get into the fact that absolutely, as others have pointed out, there are ways in which you are tracked online. There are ways in which it's obvious, for example, when you shop on Amazon, then a day later you see the same ad for the same product somewhere else. That's a violation of your privacy. It's built into the way the internet operates. And there's plenty to talk about of that, too.
Well, let's dig into some of those, Manoush Zomorodi. You did a 5-part series looking at digital privacy, and you devoted shows to what your phone knows about you, what advertisers or your social media platforms know about you. First, could you describe what your phone knows about you?
Yeah. So I think what you're referring to is we did sort of like a privacy boot camp with 30,000 of our listeners last month, and it's still ongoing. And what it was, we called it the privacy paradox. And for 5 days, every day, they would wake up and get sort of an assignment to do some of the things that Larry is talking about, and some weirder things as well, which we can talk about as well. But one day one was the favorite. It was called What Your Phone Knows. And we talked about the difference between all the data, sort of, you know, when you send an email versus all the metadata coming out of our phones. And the metadata is where you went and how fast you walked there and where you are at all times. And we talked about how companies are really using all of that data. This is their business model. It's a lot of researchers call it our behavioral exhaust online, our data exhaust. And so really you're making money for these companies simply by having a phone in your pocket, which, you know, sometimes it's great. But for example, we had one listener after he dug down into the settings on his phone, as we explained to people, which is interesting. People really didn't know how to dig down into the privacy settings. And he said the best thing that he discovered was that his flashlight app, which of course is just, you know, presumably to shed light on something, right? It had access to his microphone and his contacts and his location. And he doesn't remember ever giving them permission for that. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But the way that the technology is designed meant that he was giving away a significant amount of privacy when he thought he was just getting a flashlight app.
Yes, I think what really struck me about that segment was how you talked about, you know, we would never just allow ourselves to have to carry a tracking device around without any kind of warrant. We wouldn't want to be bugged in every room in our home or everywhere we go with our phone. Yet that's essentially what the phone is doing. It's listening to us and it's tracking all of our movements.
Well, that's exactly right. And that, I think, is why we wanted to break this very big topic of privacy down into five sort of parts. Because I think for a lot of us, regular people who just want a phone that works and would be lost if it didn't, we don't understand all the various things. So there's what Larry is talking about. Yes, strong passwords are important. And yes, two-step verification is also important. But there's a bigger question, I think, which is how we are creating a system where we are never alone because we are being tracked all the time. And we spoke to a psychologist at Stanford University who talked about the effects of when you don't have privacy, what happens with something called individuation, this idea that you have to have privacy in your life in order to mature into an adult human being. And if you are tweeting and spouting and doing everything else online and never having any of that private time, you are at risk for not maturing. So there's so many different levels that privacy can affect people.
And I want to dig into that, actually, in terms of the effects or the consequences of this. But before we do, Julia Engwin, I'd love to just hear from you about what you learned about how our social media platforms are tracking us as well. You did a lot of research about how much Facebook knows about us. Can you describe it for us?
Sure, I'm happy to. You know, I've been sort of following this topic for years now, and I continue to be astounded by the new and ever more clever ways that all of our digital devices find to collect information about us. One of the things that I did recently was just look at what Facebook says it knows about you, and so we built a tool for users who could click on a button and it would dig within the Facebook privacy settings, which are there but are hard to navigate, and show you all the different categories that Facebook had placed you in. And it was really surprising. We found that there were like more than 50,000 categories with a lot of granularity, and some of them very odd things, like you're a person who likes to pretend to text in awkward situations, which is just a weird category, and I don't know how they make that decision about you. And we also found like they, you know, are making some distinctions that are weird. They had a category, which I think they've changed the name of, but it was called ethnic affinity, and it was basically not exactly race, but sort of like if you like people of a certain race. So it was very bizarre. It was like you have an affinity for African Americans and an affinity for Hispanics. And so a lot of people were very surprised by the categories that Facebook had placed them in. But then when we did further analysis, we realized actually that there were additional categories that Facebook was not revealing to its users at all, that it had placed them in. And so it wasn't even a full picture of what they knew.
And what's amazing is Facebook is constantly tracking us even when we're not on the platform itself.
Right, exactly. So they have their code, you know, those little like buttons and share buttons that are all over the web. Those send back data to Facebook about you when you arrive. And so they get that information, and then they place ads, and those ads contain information, and they have the app. So when you're using the phone, they have a lot of information about your phone usage. So, you know, they and Google have probably the most complete picture of user behavior out there
right
now.
Yeah, they even buy data about us from other data brokers.
Yes, that's right. So we did find that they purchase a lot of data from, like, a data broker. And data brokers are people who sell information about you personally, like your name, your address, your income, your property value, your car or you drive, what kind of purchases you made last week.
And they do all this to serve us more targeted advertising experiences. Is that basically the reason behind all of this?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of most amazing thing about this is that, you know, George Orwell would have laughed to say that, like, the world's most incredibly sophisticated surveillance machine was built for the purposes of serving targeted ads. You know, and that is true. This was all sort of built to show you that custom ad that follows you around. And most of the time, we ignore those ads or find them creepy or laugh at them. But that has become the model for internet advertising. The problem is that, you know, sure, it's a creepy ad or this or that, but in the end, these are also these huge dossiers of information about us that are stored at these companies. And our government has the ability to go ask, you know, these companies under some secret order, you know, for information about us. And so it's not that it will all only result in ads, right? There eventually could be well be a day when this kind of information is used in other ways.
Yes, and Manoush Zamrota, you talked about how this information is sometimes used to set different prices for people of different ethnicities or different ethnic affinities, I guess, to use Facebook's terminology around that, based on different zip codes. And I also know that I think Julia Ng, when it was you who did a study about how Princeton Review was charging Asian Americans higher prices for their courses.
That's right. We did an analysis of how Princeton Review's online SAT tutoring was they asked you to put in your zip code before they gave you a price for the course. And what was weird was when we did an analysis and looked at the demographics of those zip codes that were predominantly Asian were much more likely to be charged a higher price than those that were not. And, you know, the company said it was inadvertent, and it may well have been, but that their pricing scheme, you know, wasn't based on race. But the result of the scheme was that, you know, these Asian neighborhoods, whether they were well off, as some of them were, or poor neighborhoods like in Queens, which is not a particularly wealthy Asian neighborhood, and they were getting prices that were sometimes twice as high as the other neighborhoods.
And Manoush Zamrota, this is legal, showing different people different prices?
Well, it is legal. I mean, that's the thing is and that's the question. You know, is this a malicious thing? No, these are algorithms. These are ways that the technologists have built things so that they perform more efficiently and deliver the product more personalized and faster. But the problem is we are seeing the knock-on effects that could not have been predicted necessarily of these algorithms that purely function based on numbers. And that, I think, is where we are in a big debate that really in a discussion that has to happen. Sure, maybe you were a technology to start with, but when we see the big companies in Silicon Valley starting to really, really affect people's lives unfairly at times or mess with people's heads, as a lot of listeners told me, what sort of ethical and moral responsibility is there to bring the humans back and double check the algorithms? I heard from, you know, my listeners, for example, one woman said that she was on Google. She was worried she had a drinking problem and was Googling around to get some more information. And then later in the day, she logged into Facebook and was served up an ad for her local liquor company. So not really nice. Another guy told me that he was a member of a very religious family, and Facebook inadvertently changed its privacy settings and revealed to his wife that he was part of an atheist group, and she divorced him. So the algorithms can have very profound human effects, and I think that there is a sort of awakening happening. I am not in San Jose. I'm in New York, so I only know by based on the people that I speak to, a sense of being morally and ethically compelled to make sure that privacy and security are considered in some way.
Larry Magid, you were getting at this earlier, that in some ways we all kind of know this. We all know that that we're probably – That institutions are probably not, you know, looking out for our best interest, right, in terms of using our information. And yet we frequently give up this information and, as you pointed out, neglect to do some of the basic cybersecurity practices.
Right.
Why is there such a disconnect?
And just to add to something Manoush said, there are things that we know and things that we don't know. For example, I've done experiments where I've used an app that tells me what apps are running on my smartphone. And, you know, you can look and say, okay, I'm running these apps. But this actually dug deep and found there were 18 apps running on my phone that I didn't launch, that I wasn't aware were running. And you couldn't tell it through the regular Android way of knowing what apps were running. So these are things that are just sort of happening to you as you walk around simply having them on your phone. And so it's very deep. But I do think that one of the things we have to explore is not only what they know, but what they do with the information. So, for example, your bank knows a lot about you. If you use a loyalty card at a store or even just a credit card at a store, there's a huge amount of information that these companies know about us. It's always been the case. That was the case 30 years ago. I remember once getting to Los Angeles and thinking nobody knew I was there, but realizing the airline knew, my bank knew, my rental car company knew, the phone company knew. But the question is, what are they doing with it? If they're simply using the information to better serve you, then that's legitimate. So it's okay, for example, that Google Maps knows where I am because that's the only way they can serve me is by knowing where I am. It's not okay that the flashlight knows where you are. There's no reason why it does. But what are the other policies behind it? What are their privacy policies? Are they adhering to their privacy policies? And probably most important, do you and I and most mortals have any way of actually understanding their privacy policies? And one of the things that continually shocks me when I hear the research that folks like Julia and Manoush come out with is I'm constantly learning things that I didn't even know. And I study this very carefully in terms of what they're doing with our information. And that's something that I think we all have a right to know.
Well, Julia Engwin, speaking of a right to know, how easy is it to find out what these companies know about us if we make an inquiry?
Well, that is a great question because we are actually one of the only Western nations that doesn't have a law that gives us the right to access our data when it's stored at a commercial data provider. So in Europe and Canada, all have these laws that say basically if there's a commercial data provider, they need to show you what they have on you, and you should have the right to correct or delete maybe that information if it's incorrect, sort of the way we have that right with credit reports right now. But we don't have it with these other data brokers. So I actually, as part of my book about privacy, Dragnet Nation, went and tried to find all my data at all these data brokers. First of all, coming up with a list was not easy. I finally did manage to identify more than 200 different entities that potentially had information about me. And of those, only 33 offered the option of letting you see the data, and of those, only a dozen actually did show me the information they had on me. And it's also worth noting that even if I wanted to just opt out of their database without seeing the information, that's also not required by law in this country. So I could not opt out of many of those databases. I think I only opted out of 92 of the 212 that I found.
Wow. Manoush Zomorodi, could you talk about the privacy paradox? What that is.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's running through my mind. And this is why we called our project the Privacy Paradox, because that's exactly what this is all about, that we love the convenience of living online, that you really can't be a person in the modern world without having a LinkedIn profile if you want to get a job, or a Facebook profile if you want to stay in touch with family across the country. But we don't like this feeling that we have no say over where our personal information goes or who is looking at it. Pew Research came out with a stat that I think puts it really well, that 74% of Americans say that being in control of who can get information about us is very important. And yet here we are, you know, how many times a day do you log into something or download something onto your phone without reading the terms of service. And I'm not saying you should, because actually you shouldn't bother. There's another study that says it would take you 22 days of your life every year to read all the terms of service for all the products that you use. But I think the point for us was, well, you know, somebody like Julia, obviously, who knows so much, takes privacy incredibly seriously. And maybe there's somebody out there who wants privacy in their life for the principle of it, because not because they necessarily have something to hide, but because this is an American right, right? I mean, there's the Fourth Amendment is all about this right to privacy that Americans have. And so as we go further into this, creating a system where we automatically hand over access to our most intimate information, and I don't even just mean like our bank accounts, but who we spend time with and what we really think and our beliefs, we need to start wondering, you know, is there something we can do about it more broadly, more than just setting up two-step password verification? And what we found was very interesting with our five-day plan was that afterwards, well, first, before our project, 37% of our listeners strongly agreed that data will need to be regulated. And now 64% of them agree. 87% said that the project showed them privacy invasions that they didn't know existed. And perhaps most interestingly is that when we asked everyone, you know, these 30,000 people, does this project make you want to give up or what? And only 7% said give up, but 70% said that it made them want to do something to push for protection of our digital rights. Because, you know, Mina, we spend, just to throw another statistic at you, on average, 11 hours in front of a screen every single day. And so our lives are really happening as much virtually as they are in real life. And yet we don't have the legal protection of our digital life as much as we do on boots on the ground. So I think we're at this moment where we start to have to say, wait a second, this is going down a path that needs to be course corrected.
We're talking about digital privacy, or the lack thereof, with Manoush Zomorodi. She is host of Note to Self, the tech podcast about being human from WNYC Studios. We're also talking with Larry Magid, technology journalist, internet safety advocate, and CEO and co-founder of ConnectSafely.org. He also serves as an on-air technology analyst for CBS, KCBS, and the Mercury News. And we're talking with Julia Engwin, a senior reporter for ProPublica and also the author of Dragnet Nation. From social media companies to advertisers to the government, institutions are scooping up as much data about our online activity as they can to predict our behaviors and, you know, provide advertising to us. And we're learning in this hour why they're doing it and why it matters for you to know about it. And we'd like to invite you to join the conversation. How much privacy do you expect or feel like you have a right to when you search for things, buy things, or talk to people or connect with people online? Are you conflicted about this? Do you like the conveniences of big data since it's tailored toward you, but yet you don't like the invasion of privacy that it creates? Other thoughts you have about the state of digital privacy? The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on Facebook. You can post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. After the break, we'll talk about ways that we can take some control of our digital privacy that goes beyond just making stronger passwords. So stay with us for that. I'm Mina Kim, broadcasting today from the Silicon Valley desk in San Jose. You're listening to Forum from KQED Silicon Valley desk in San Jose. I'm Mina Kim, and I'm joined by Manoush Zomorodi, host of Note to Self, Julia Engwin, senior reporter for ProPublica, and Larry Magid, technology journalist, internet safety advocate, and CEO and co-founder of ConnectSafely.org. We're talking about digital privacy, which is feeling ever more elusive these days as we give up more and more personal information for the conveniences of communicating with each other and searching and buying things quickly. And we're hearing from you, our listeners, about your questions and concerns about digital privacy. Lurleen writes, I honestly believe the days of digital privacy are gone. The so-called sharing economy is in full force, and that means we'll have more people looking into our cyber windows, potentially tracking our every move. The solution? Don't do anything you don't want the rest of the world to know about. William writes, Mark Zuckerberg covers his laptop's camera. As someone who is not a Facebook user, how big should my grin be? And let's also hear from Kristen in San Jose. Hi, Kristen.
Hello. I have two questions. One question and a comment. How can we get the information from these participants today, the guests, so that we can inquire into our own information that is being stolen and used? And secondly, children who give up their privacy on social media do so without ever knowing what privacy is, and it's changed the way our whole entire social structure is for younger people.
Thanks, Kristen. Larry Megan.
Well, on the issue of children, it may surprise you, but there have been a couple of studies have done that at least among teenagers, they're actually more privacy conscious than many adults realize. The difference is that they don't care about the same institutions adults care about. They're not as worried about the government and commercial, but they are concerned about their friends, their parents, their teachers. So depending on how you define privacy and who you define privacy from, kids are actually more conscious than many adults may realize. And in fact, often it is adults that fail to do things like set their privacy settings on Facebook appropriately or check their Google activity monitor. I'm not saying all kids are doing that as well, but talk to your kids, especially teens. If you have teens, ask them about privacy, and you may be surprised that they know more than you think they know.
Well, on the topic of kids, Larry Magid, for those who are younger than, you know, teens and not controlling their online, I guess, footprint, how conscious should parents be about when they're posting information about their children, that they're giving information away about them to these companies at a very early age before they have a say in it?
That's right. I mean, if you're talking about a 4, 5, 6-year-old, you can't really expect them to be protecting their own privacy yet. They should be learning over time. But what about the parents that are posting all of this stuff about their kids? I had a relative who was publishing pictures of her young daughter in ways that I thought were inappropriate. Photographs that, sure, for among the family, fine. But these could be seen publicly by anybody out there. And even if they weren't inappropriate, the mere fact that these pictures are out there a lot, I think that parents need to take a deep breath and think about this and maybe have a conversation with their children. Do you want me to share this? Probably the kid will say okay, but get that as part of the conversation early and think about your responsibility. I don't know about, you know, there are literally pictures of kids before they're born. The sonograms are posted. I'm not sure that's such a bad thing. But certainly once your kids are, you know, toddlers, you need to think about their privacy rights as well.
Well, Julia Engwin, are companies scooping up this information about, say, our kids? And, of course, I also don't want to forget Kristen's earlier question about also resources if we want to find out what and get access to what data companies have on us.
So in terms of resources, you know, Manoush has a lot on her Privacy Paradox website, but I also, on my own personal website, juliaengwin.com, I have a section on the homepage called Privacy Tips, and it's all a lot of the it's information about all the tools I use and also a list of the 212 data brokers that I went to and where you could go to try to get your information from them. So that might be helpful. In terms of kids, it's a tough question because we are in a world where you can't participate fully without exchanging data. And so, you know, for my children, I try really hard to keep them off the internet, but my daughter's 12, so I kind of lost that battle a few years ago. So what I do now, which is sad, but it seems like the only option, and it's kind of controversial, but I insist on her using fake names and also separate fake names for each account so they can't be as easily triangulated. I think that children really should have the opportunity to shed their identities, you know, just the way that in 7th grade and 8th grade I only wore pink and turquoise. There's no record of that, you know, and that's a joy for me every day to know that there's no record. So I would like my daughter to be able to shed those things also, and so unfortunately the only tool she has is sort of this masking her identity. So I hope that that will give her those options, but that's not like an ideal situation. That's kind of like a sad situation.
Well, here's something that Marina writes. I would use more secure communications, but getting others to do so is next to impossible. Sharing on social platforms helps maintain social connections with others, so there's a trade-off between sharing versus isolation. Getting off the grid would be hard. Manoush Zomorodi, it's true that some of these, you know, more well-protected, for lack of a better description, right, applications, not a lot of people are on them.
No, that is the truth. And that is why on day one, actually, we also asked people as that day's challenge to get on the app called Signal. So this is an encrypted text messaging app. And, you know, I had, of course, a lot of listeners are like, well, I don't need encrypted text messaging. I'm not saying anything bad or wrong. And that's not the point, though. The point is that if we all get on Signal or an encrypted text messaging or we make encrypted email just a normal thing, then we can do it for the greater good of society, for people who may be worried that their origins or their beliefs or their background could potentially be held against them. Bruce Schneier, the cryptographer, said to me, he's like, it's like if everybody uses a postcard and then you use an envelope, the envelope is suspicious. But if everybody uses an envelope, then an envelope is just an envelope. And so I think we're, again, at this point where in society we have to say, as consumers, we want encryption. We want protected email. We want these things built into our technology, and so that we make it sort of a business incentive for the technologists, which I think is kind of the next step. I have a 9-year-old who just got email, and I found an encrypted email service, and that is what he has, and he thought that was super cool. So we'll see how long it lasts. But, you know, I'm watching Julia for tips going forward. And I would say to your other listener that, you know, this I think it's we heard from a lot of families who did the Privacy Paradox Project together. And this idea of breaking it down into fun ways of talking about what is even privacy in this day and age. Because when I was growing up, it was about being left alone. And now it's really about control over our identity and our personal information.
It's a really interesting point. And let's hear now from Bruce in Oakland. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
So with all this talk about digital privacy and major companies being able to have this, you know, even social media sites like Facebook, you know, what is preventing people from being able to hack in? Isn't that where hackers go to collect information to steal identities?
Well,
Larry Magid.
Very good question. I know that there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party that are concerned about that as well. It's become part of our national conversation since the alleged Russian hacking of the election. But it's not just political operatives who are hacked. It could be literally anybody. And it's very common, for example, somewhat common, I should say, for Facebook accounts to be hacked, for people to steal someone's identity for the purposes of maybe getting somebody to give them money. There's just a number of things. So that's one of the reasons why it is so important we use two-factor authentication, that we have very strong passwords, that we don't fall for phishing scams the way allegedly what happened to at least one of the Democratic operatives. These are ways in which bad guys can access our information. So it's also important that Silicon Valley step up and improve security. We've already seen, for example, fingerprint and other biometrics coming into our phones. There are some efforts going in this direction. Also, end-to-end encryption, both on our devices and our apps, like WhatsApp does end-to-end encryption. It doesn't solve the problem. But these are real issues, and I'm very glad you raised it. And I think we all have to go out of our way. Now, since I think with Julia mentioned resources, ConnectSafely.org also has extensive resources on privacy and security, as well as other internet safety articles and guides for families. So there's a lot of good information out there, but we need not only to read it, but actually follow it.
Julia Engwin, what do you use for search? Do you use Google anymore?
Every once in a while I might do a Google search, but I primarily use something called DuckDuckGo, which is a privacy-protecting search engine, and it doesn't store the search queries that I make. So I find it, you know, it does require a little bit more work because you know how when you're typing into Google, it finishes the word for you, and it's
yes.
Even if you weren't actually planning to search that, you're like, oh, yeah, good idea, Google, thank you. DuckDuckGo, I just have to write it out myself, but I really prefer that they're not keeping that information about me. And they make money just in the normal way that back in the old days people made money, which is there's just 3 ads next to every search result, and they don't need to track me to do that.
It's interesting, Manu Zamarodi also brought up the point, Julia Engwin, about normalizing, you know, using more protected services, right? Because you talked about feeling like you might be a target because you were one of the few people who you were doing things that were not, you know, in the norm. Right. I think the other direction, though, that we're going in terms of normalizing surveillance is something that also needs to be discussed. Of course, we have this proposal by the Trump administration to require as a condition of getting a visa to this country to give up your social media passwords. And could you just talk a little bit, Julia Engwin, about what that means, it not just for the person who's giving up their passwords, but for everybody they're connected to?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a shocking proposal, right? The idea that you would have to give up your passwords. I mean, you wouldn't give your house keys to somebody just to get a visa to travel, right? And that's essentially what it is. It's like, in some ways, more intimate, right? Because once you get into the house, you still would have to find all the intimate things in that house, where in your phone, which is more like most likely where they would use it or whatever, they can get all your contacts, your direct, your private messages, you know, sexy texts you might have sent to friends. And, you know, it's a very intimate thing that they're asking for, and it doesn't seem to me like that is necessary. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine how this is going to increase public safety in any way. If anything, it's just going to create a very insecure database of all these people's messages, which will then get hacked and leaked, right? I mean, this is unfortunately what we've learned about databases. The government's own background check database, the most private information where they asked all these people information about their backgrounds, and they disclosed drug use and affairs and all these things, and then it got hacked. And so if the government can't keep our information safe, I don't think they can. I think it's really unfair to ask for the most intimate information that we have, especially without presenting some incredibly important public safety reason for it.
And Manu Zamarodi, we touched on this earlier, but what are the consequences of feeling like you don't have a private space?
Yeah, I mean, when Julia was saying that, I just kept thinking, you know, that what is normal today was actually considered not normal not that long ago. We are at a point in our country now where gay people can get married. Being a biracial couple is, you know, not a big deal. And if you think about how do we get to that point where societies evolve and become more accepting, you need some people to talk about it and do it in private, right? And then slowly, this becomes what society accepts. So what may be considered nefarious or unacceptable behavior now that potentially the government could get access to, who's deciding that? So I just wanted to mention that. Sorry, Mina, remind me, what did you just ask me?
Yes, well, you had mentioned earlier about individuation and some of the consequences feeling like you don't have a private spot.
Yeah, so this was some of the things that was based on was this Stanford psychiatrist to whom I spoke, who does research on OCD and also has not only does the research, but also sees a lot of Stanford undergraduates. And, you know, this idea of, like Larry mentioned early on, this idea of posting things that you really regret and wish that you had never posted. But he's also seeing a lot of behavior of anxiety, a lot of things related to technology, this need to constantly checking all the time. I think it's interesting with the Snapchat IPO that happened yesterday, how a lot of these technologies are built, their businesses are built on what's called user engagement. And really what that means is that you are spending as much time as possible on that platform. And it is built to sort of prey on your weaknesses. So, for example, with Snapchat, there's something called streaks. This is like you collect points and badges if you go back and forth with someone sending each other messages enough days in a row. And there are stories of kids who are going on vacation with their parents and they give their logins to somebody else, or like, don't let the streak end. I've been playing around with Snapchat, and you can see when somebody is typing something to you. And then the other day, somebody stopped typing something to me. There's a lot of passive aggression in like somebody typing, and then they decide not to send something to you. Like, you're sort of spinning your wheels mentally on something when really what you should be thinking about is less about the snap and maybe more about, what do I want to do with my life, right? I think that we get so distracted and bogged down in a lot of these tools and give away our privacy that we sort of often lose sight of what's the purpose in all of these tools. Are they tools, or are we the tools, actually?
Well, let's hear now from Scott in Mill Valley. Hi, Scott.
Well, I think you just made great points there. It's almost like we're a casino customer sitting in front of a slot machine. Basically, you know,
and actually there's research, Scott, that has exactly tied that to Natasha Dow-Schul at NYU has done research comparing slot machines exactly to social media and other things like that. So you're spot on.
That's why I guess I'm lucky enough to be older that I never got a Facebook, although my wife and kids had them. But it's just the time suck I see is just amazing. And then nobody's actually happier, are they? Really?
Well, I want to push back a little bit if I can. I mean, I'm happier because I have Facebook. I mean, I love the fact that I'm in touch with old friends and family, and that I could have all these great conversations with colleagues and go about and debate what's happening politically in the world. So I don't think it's all bad. I think the question is, are we, A, maximizing our privacy to the extent that we want to? Now, I actually choose to publish publicly on Facebook most of the time because I want to share what I'm doing globally to a lot of people. But I'm also very careful what I put on, just like I'm careful what I'm saying in this program. There's certain things I'm not going to talk about on the radio, right, because they're private. But so I don't think we should negate the value of having a public life, whether it's public within our own circle of friends or the entire world, as long as we have control and have visibility in terms of what's being used with that information.
Right. We have control over the degree to which we want to be out there, right? And it reminds me, Manoj Zomorodi, of the quiz that you put out there that basically asked people to figure out what is their comfort level with what's out there
The whole point of our challenge was to help people learn not only where does their information go, but to help them weigh the trade-offs and then make digital decisions that they felt sort of aligned with their values. And so that marker is going to be different for everyone. So what we did was we made a privacy personality quiz because, again, we wanted this to be fun. But it was actually based on sociologist Alan Weston's work into how Americans feel about privacy in the 70s and 80s. And we made it into a fun quiz, and you take a bunch of questions on privacy and your thoughts on it, and then we have you you could be a believer. This is someone who puts faith in the principle of privacy. They never feel relaxed providing personal information. They probably watch Mr. Robot or Black Mirror. Or you could be the realist. This is somebody who will often choose convenience over any hard line principle. I am on the boundary between realist and believer. I still use Google search. As you could hear, Julia is definitely a believer. And then there's mostly probably watch like Homeland or Silicon Valley or House of Cards, if you're a realist. And then there's the shrugger who can't understand how we ever got through life without Google Maps. And they just think, you know, these targeted ads are helpful. Hacker's going to hack. Maybe they watch Downton Abbey or The Bachelor, you know, something that where they didn't have. Yeah. So, I mean, this idea is that, you know, we all feel very differently about privacy. But the key point is that we should all have a choice. This should be up to us. And when we sign up for these services that we get for free, which are amazing. I mean, I use Google Docs. But, you know, I think the problem is, why do I get to have to hand over my personal information every single time that I use it? How did this happen that we are now in a system where we can't even pay for it if we want to? We have to pay with our behavior, with our data, with our identity. And right. So choice matters.
Well, speaking of Google, Michael asks, Google is effectively a monopoly, giving away products for free and basing its business on ads. The consequence is that competitors who might honor privacy cannot thrive. Can antitrust law do something about this? Julia Angwin, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there are some antitrust investigations going on into Google in Europe right now, but the U.S. regulators have taken a pass on that question. And so, you know, it's hard to know where that's going to shake out. But I will say this. I spend a huge amount of time myself looking, searching out for competitors to support, and I actually try to pay for services because I want the relationship to be clean. If I'm not paying for a service, then they're going to have to sell my data to make money. So I'm not always successful, you know. So interestingly, it's very hard to find a paid email service that fit with my criteria for security and privacy. So that market is hard. I do use a private email service, but it's donation and it's not for everyone. It's called RiseUp.net, and it's really designed for activism. But I'm really happy that there are some things that fit my model. So I use a password manager, which gives me the ability to have encrypted strong passwords on my different devices. And one password is $60 or so, and totally worth it to have secure passwords. I have an encrypted cloud.
So it's called 1Password.
1Password is the name.
Sorry, it's called 1Password, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I know I have an encrypted cloud service where I store my data on the cloud in encryption instead of using Google Drive because Google can read my files. They have the key to unlock that encryption, whereas I use a service where only I have the key. It's called sync.com, S-Y-N-C. Mm-hmm. It's Canadian, and I pay quite a bit of money to them, I think. $100 a year. So, but I would rather do that. You know, at this point, we live so much of our life online, and it's important to me to pay for services, and I want them to have me as their customer, that they want to make me happy as opposed to making the advertisers happy by giving them data about me.
Well, a listener asks, even if a company says they will delete your information, can it even delete it? Does our data ever really get deleted or erased?
That's such a good
Julia
question.
Julia Angwin?
You know,
yeah.
The truth is that you can never really tell if they've deleted it. So, as you know, probably, if you've ever dropped a hard drive or computer and lost your information, and there are companies that can go and sort of forensically recover data even when you think you've deleted it from your device. And so that's true for all types of computers. So whether companies truly delete it in a way that could never be recovered is hard to know. And actually, what's really hard to know is whether they deleted it at all, right? Since we have no access rights, we're not allowed to see the data that companies hold against us. We can't check that they deleted it. Facebook says they have two options. You can delete your account or deactivate it. And if you delete, they say they delete your data after a certain amount of time. But, you know, there's no way for anyone to verify that that's true.
Well, Michael asks,
with Apple. Sorry, I was just going to say there was a case with Apple where they discovered that there was a trove of consumer data, people who had thought they deleted something and then it was stored on a server.
Mm-hmm. And remember, the data doesn't live in one spot and another spot. It's going through servers.
Yes.
And, for example, if you send something to someone else, they have it on their system. So it literally is impossible to know for sure that your data is gone.
Well, Michael asks, so why is it that LinkedIn is required for getting a new job? And he gets to, of course, the role that the expectation, right, that we are searchable, that people are connected with other people, even as a condition of employment or to make you look more attractive to an employer. So what is that role in all of this, Manoush Zomorodi?
Yeah, I had a lot of people. I had several stay-at-home parents who were getting ready to go back into the work world and really frustrated that they're like, I don't post pictures of my kids and I take privacy very seriously. But now to be considered a relevant person in the world, as you say, I have to be searchable. And they're frustrated that this is the situation for them. You know, I don't know that necessarily taking small steps is the answer here. I went to visit Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who is the inventor of the World Wide Web and he's at MIT and has professed to be very frustrated with how his invention has sort of been perverted in some way. And so he's sort of looking at, could we flip this model? Could we make it so that instead of you logging into Facebook would have to log into you that you would decide what information you would want to share and grant the keys or grant that information. And then you'd also be able to take it back. With LinkedIn, there are ways, though, you know, think very carefully about what you write and put yourself in the mind of someone else who is reading that and how you want to present yourself. I mean, there is a way to sort of curate a persona that you feel allows you to still retain a little bit of your private self, your intimate self, the person that you want to only share with those most close to you or maybe not share at all. And I think as we sort of understood based on our discussions with psychologists and sociologists and cognitive neuroscientists, that little bit of privacy in your life is incredibly crucial to your well-being.
Well, let me see if I can sneak in. Yes, Julie Angwin.
I did delete my LinkedIn, and I was nervous about whether I'd ever get a job again. And I have, I did subsequently switch jobs, and I have been very happy without it. The truth is that, I mean, I think it's important to have an online presence, but I have my own website, and so I can curate that nicely, and I don't have to sort of deal with the annoying LinkedIn requests and all these bizarre recommendations that people make for each other. And the truth is that how real is that? You know, everybody knows that that is not actually, that you're only going to see the best version of somebody on those platforms. So why not just build your own version? These days it's pretty cheap to build your own website.
Well, Helen asks, so should I assume my computer knows I'm emailing Forum now? I'm also being told that today is the National Day of Unplugging, and there's more info at nationaldayofunplugging.com, which feels very timely. Corinne writes, as a 24-year-old, I've spent many of my formative years online, and I just took it for granted that the things I say and do online are never private. This podcast is making me consider that maybe this isn't the way things should be, and I thank your guests for that. And I think this gets at what you were saying, Manu Samarodi, earlier about, you know, what the inventor of the internet is proposing. It's really a paradigm shift, essentially.
Well, absolutely.
Manu Samarodi, I want to thank you for joining us, host of Note to Self.
Thank you so much, Mina.
Yes, it was a pleasure. Julia Angwin, also senior reporter ProPublica, thank you.
Thank you.
And Larry Magid, technology journalist, internet safety advocate, and co-founder of ConnectSafely.org. Thanks for being here this morning.
Pleasure.
And thanks to our team, Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, Jeremy Siegel, Danny Bringer, Amanda Stupai, Stephanie Roberts, Devin Holt, Steve Pinch, Bruce Kuhn, Roger Chung, Phil Manley, and Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.